You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm Weston Williams, joined by Oliver Camacho and Matt Cummings. All right, this week, the final four of the Best School for Singing bracket is here. Will a top seed prevail? And then in listener mailbag, PJ and Donald give us a preview of La Rondinée at the Met, which features the house debut of friend of the show Emily Pogoreltz. Plus, in the two-minute drill, we ignore opera completely and talk about the CSO for once. Unfortunately, Symphony Box Score just doesn't have the same ring to it. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, click follow. On Apple Podcasts, hit the plus sign, send us a voice memo, or email us your hot takes. mailbag@operaboxscore.com, or you can just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com. However you contribute, you'll get an OBS beer coaster, an OBS lapel pin, and a number one OBS fan foam finger just for sharing your own hot take. And without further ado, Oliver Camacho, it's so nice to see you.
I'm sorry, I can't see any of you because I did not heed the warnings of everybody and I stared directly into the eclipse. And now I have a retina burn.
Here I thought that we were going to not talk about the eclipse because that's all I've seen all day in my entire, every single feed, every email.
Both of you have a banana-shaped purple spot on your faces right now.
Matt Cummings, how is your banana-shaped purple spot?
Is it even worth it if it wasn't in totality? Like, that just seems like a waste.
It didn't even go fully dark here. What a ripoff. We could have had this episode remotely. With Ashley Hargrave seeing the totality with her.
I know. I'm really excited for Ashley's update about whether or not the state of emergency for her town was in fact necessary.
Well, we'll let you all know next week if Ashley Hargrave survived the apocalyptic crossing of planetary bodies.
She was raptured, yeah.
We'll see if that happened. Until then, let's talk some opera.
Chalk Talk on Opera Box Score.
So we're recording on April 8th on a Monday, as always. And yesterday, Iowa was defeated by one of the Carolinas. I forget which one.
South Carolina.
And, you know, we all heard about this Caitlin Clark phenomenon. But in the end, South Carolina had a perfect season. And then today, as we record, the Boilermakers are just about to meet the Huskies. I like Huskies. I've always had a crush on Huskies. So we'll see what happens. By the time you hear this episode, a NCAA men's champion will be crowned. But when you hear this program, you will also know who is going to win the first Opera Box Score, Where to Go to School, Sweet 16, if you're a singer.
Which everyone is also watching with just as bated breath as the results of March Madness.
Hopefully not, because they need that breath for their support.
Because it has nothing to do with your own talent. It has to do with where you want to go. I just want to say I got some feedback from somebody in academia that our research was shoddy leading up to our Final Four. So we took this seriously, and we really want to give you good metrics for these two matches, and then we will declare a winner. And we have not decided who is going through in advance, so we're really going to talk about this in real time. So the first bracket sees Curtis Institute versus San Francisco Conservatory. Matt, you did the good research on Curtis. What do you have to say?
So the Curtis Institute of Music is really like the top dog here. Their teachers are a veritable who's who of Northeastern excellence, including like Julia Faulkner, who is one of the most in-demand voice teachers in the entire world at this time. Trish McCaffrey, who has held that title for quite some time as well. Friend of the show, Eric Owens, the incredible Delora Zajic, whose love of pedagogy started her to create that Institute for Dramatic Voices. Like this, she's not just a singer who's interested in, having a faculty job on her resume and being her retirement from the stage. Like, this is a real passion of hers and something that she's really invested in. Now that institute is not at Curtis, but you have to believe that, like, you know, we're talking about connections here. There's an inside track. And it's not just their teachers where the excellence lies. Like, of their coaches, the head opera coach, Miloš Repitsky, he's also on staff at the Met. One of the master coaches, Grant Lehnig, is head of music staff at Opera Philadelphia. Like, these are the people that students are working with day in and day out and have getting to know their voices as they are, like, as they're working, and then are going to be hearing them for jobs. Their director of opera, Chad Schreiber, has directed over 30 performances at Curtis, but he also works regularly at regional houses like Des Moines Metro Opera or Operas Arizona or Portland Opera, like exactly the kind of companies where these young grads are going to be, like, going out and getting work within the next couple of years, hopefully. And that's just the faculty piece of it.
They're meeting up against the faculty of San Francisco. The chair is Catherine Cook. One of their prominent teachers is Rosalind Jones, who also is a teacher for the Adler Fellowship, and she's on faculty of Marola and Chautauqua. And coincidentally, she went to Curtis. But I mean, it seems like singing for Rosalind gets your foot in the door for Marola or Chautauqua, which is a good thing if you are, you know, that age of singer and you need to, like, get your foot in the door in one of those places. Lester Lynch, working baritone, Suzanne Mentzer, legacy, you know, great American artist, Jane Randolph, Cesar Ulloa, and Matthew Wirth, another young singer, baritone, who is working and is sort of the darling of American opera. I think it's good to have people who are, you know, still working and still in their careers. And we know that even though he's not necessarily going to be working with the voice students per se, they have added Michael Tilson Thomas to their distinguished faculty.
Yeah, very recently, a couple days ago.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe you'll end up singing some Mahler songs with MTT.
What does he know about Mahler?
One metric we're looking at is the ratio of students to singers. So
yeah.
There are approximately 93 students. There's 93 and a half students in the voice program. So it's like 1 to 13.
I mean, and that's just actual voice teachers. Like, I don't think that the faculty to student ratio would be limited to that. Like, it would probably include coaches and pianists and directors and acting teachers. And
okay. I will also dovetail on connections. As we talked about recently, working at being a student at San Francisco gives you a chance to work with faculty on Adler and Marola. The students apparently have access to San Francisco opera rehearsals and performances.
Hmm.
We know that the school has an alliance with the record label Pentatone, as well as an unusual, maybe unethical, alliances with Opus 3 artists and Ascanus Halt management companies.
At Curtis, it looks like they typically do about 3 stage opera performances a year. There might be a concert version of an opera thrown in at some point. And those performance opportunities are shared among a very small, very, very, very small student body of, it looks like, about 25 students in the voice faculty in the voice department at a time. The whole school is only about 150 students total. They only admit as many people as they need to have a full orchestra and run this opera program. And that would come down to something like maybe even like a 2-to-1 student to teacher ratio. The shows may generally be smaller at times due to the low head count of, like, just people who need to be involved compared to peer institutions. One peer institution in particular that is about 10 times the size of Curtis. But shows are selected there to highlight the incumbent singers, and the singers often will rotate through lead and supporting roles to get a wide variety of experience. This year they're doing a staged oratorio, the Handel L'Allegro e Penseroso ed il Moldorato, then a double bill of Mamel de Tiresias and the Vile Dance Ballet, opera ballet, Seven Deadly Sins, and then closing out the season with a much bigger show, Cunning Little Vixen. And that's just the opera performances. Like, there are many recital options and performance opportunities beyond opera. And when you're talking about, like, just the access, I mean, Philadelphia is smack dab in the middle of that northeastern corridor. You've got... you have New York at your fingertips as well. And many of the teachers here also maintain studios in New York. And some of them even, I don't know if anyone is still doing this. I believe that when the departed, the much beloved and departed Marlena Malice taught at Curtis. Her studio she maintained was in New York, and the students would commute up to go see her from Philadelphia rather than her coming down to Philadelphia. But they're very close together. And so you have all those opportunities for like enrichment and performance and gigging work if you can stand it on top of a on top of the what sounds like a very demanding curriculum is right there, as well as a close relationship with Opera Philadelphia.
I have visited the campus of Curtis, and it's quaint, to be charitable. The facility itself is very, you know, beautiful, but it's not generous. And even their venue for, the venue I saw Amanda Majeski and Karen Slack sing in when they were giving recitals there as part of Opera Philadelphia's Opera Festival. I'm not sure if that space is where they also put on operas. It's a very small space. I haven't been to San Francisco, but I just imagine with, you know, a much bigger campus and a much bigger...
Sure, but like, which name would you rather have on your diploma at the end of the day?
Yeah.
And which tuition would you rather pay? Would you rather pay nothing to go to Curtis?
That's sort of like the unfair metric, which you can't really use to say that it's a better school just because it's free.
Oh, I disagree with that. I mean, speaking as, you know, someone who has people very close to me who are six figures in debt for much less well-known schools, that is not a nothing consideration.
I mean, you have to get it. You have to be one of the seven people that got in last year in order to get that. Which is unheard of. But,
okay, so let's say that if you could get into Curtis.
If God himself picks you to attend Curtis.
Obviously, you're getting a lot of attention. Everybody's going to know who you are. And you just put Curtis on your resume and people will take you seriously.
People want to hear you.
Yeah. I will say it's almost like if you're going to get in Curtis, I mean, just getting into Curtis is almost the point of getting into Curtis. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know,
it's already a career getting into Curtis
because they're not going to put their stamp on approval on anyone who's anything less than exemplary. I mean, this is it in some ways. I think it's almost like a little bit closer to like a professional training program than it is to a conservatory.
Due to the connections
and how dialed in it is to like the nucleus of the music of the music taste makers in the Northeast. But if you can go, that's like a surefire way to get people's attention.
So I guess we're handing it to Curtis so we can move on to this. I'm sorry, San Francisco. Actually, I was beginning to buy into the whole San Francisco idea. Especially
it's a tough face off there.
No, but I mean, especially with their alliances with management companies and
I'm very interested to see what ends up happening there. It's kind of too soon to say like whether or not I think it was successful or as you pointed out, ethical, but it might be an interesting development as things go on.
But I mean, even if it's unethical, they will learn about that part of the business. Which is part of the business.
That's you gotta learn somehow.
So moving on to the other semifinal, we ended up with University of North Texas representing, I guess, the South, and the school, Indiana, Jacobs School of Music, representing the Central region. I will go ahead and start with University of North Texas. Faculty includes Daniel Bubeck, Jennifer Lane, Stephen Morshek, Jeffrey Snyder, and stage director Jonathan Eaton. There are no names that, you know, really, I think, jump out when you hear that faculty. That doesn't mean anything about their ability to teach or their, you know, success rate with their students. I do know Jennifer Lane personally, and I, you know, I'm a fan of her singing, as well as Daniel Bubeck, the countertenor. Stephen Morshek was famously in the Ryan Opera Center, what it used to be called LOCA, the Lyric Opera Center for American Artists back in the day. So I got to hear him sing a lot when he was up and coming. And he has a great head of hair. The facility has, it's called the Lyric Theater at the Murchison Performing Arts Center. And, you know, the idea of being at UNT is that you have access to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, which is, you know, a growing arts community. I don't think people think, oh yeah, Dallas, Fort Worth, that's where the best opera is happening. But, you know, there was a time where Dallas and Fort Worth were like very cool companies and had, you know, cash, had a clout because of their adventurousness. Not sure how that's panning out for either of those companies.
There's been a decent amount of turnover since those days. I'm not sure. I don't think the same people are in charge.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with
that. Collectively, they have 75 students in the voice department, including the post-grad departments. But there are 9 full-time faculty and 3 adjunct professors. So the ratio is pretty good. It's like 1-7, roughly, student to teacher. I want to go ahead and talk about some Indiana faculty.
Yeah, so in Indiana, there are, I mean, a real bouquet of like big name faculties. You've got Wolfgang Brendel. You've got Michelle DeYoung. You've got Heidi Grant Murphy. You've got friend of the show, Russell Thomas. You've got Carol Vaness. And then on top of that, like there are a handful of teachers who maybe don't have like the same kind of name recognition, but about which I hear like really good things from peers of mine that have studied with them. Patricia Stiles is one that really comes to mind. And Catherine Compton as well, just to call them out. But like it's a humongous faculty. And, and because it is a humongous school, there are 1,500 students at Jacobs altogether. I can't find exactly how many of those are voice and opera students specifically, but it's usually one of the bigger departments broken up in there. And they do call out that they have like a 7-to-1 faculty to student ratio as well. So on par with UNT.
And they have Kevin Murphy in the collaborative piano department. And
yeah, so many professors that I couldn't even name all of them.
Yeah, but I mean, I would say that like getting to sing for Kevin Murphy seems to be a way into the Ravinia Steens Music Institute, which is in the Chicago area, like the place where people go to like, you know, work with really big names for the summer and specialize in art song. That's Kevin Murphy is running that program now. And he's bringing a lot of people over from Indiana to participate in that program. Fair or not, that's happening.
Well, I think it's really interesting that we have another situation where it's the networking advantage, right? Kind of like Curtis, you know, the big names, the connections are.
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's exactly the same just because there are so many people at Indiana.
You could certainly wind up, you know, because of the size of the faculty, wind up with someone who does not have the same level of connections as your average Curtis, you know, professor. But that being said, you're rubbing shoulders with a lot of people who do have an impact in the industry.
Right. The opportunity is there if you can grab onto it and, you know, like kind of. Like you kind of have to roll the dice again to see if you're gonna like be a star there in a way that you don't at a smaller program.
Yeah,
UNT touts 3 main stage productions, which would be double cast with the UNT orchestras in the Lyric Theater. Recent shows have been "Rape of Lucretia," "The Bartered Bride," Blitzstein's "Regina," "Cunning Little Vixen," Virgil Thomson's "Mother of Us All." So they're not just doing the super canonical works. They also say that there is an opportunity to do one of the special projects, 1-2 per year, collaborating with the early music department. They've done Popea, they've done Alcina, they've done Cavalli's Legisto. There's also a chance to do opera and concert or maybe chamber opera. And they recently did a world premiere in collaboration with the theory department.
Ooh.
Yes.
Go bring out the nerds. Yeah.
What about opportunities in Indiana?
So Indiana has one of the largest like physical spaces for theater in the entire Midwest. I believe that its stage is comparable to the Met, which is why they've been getting some attention recently with like co-workshopping some things like that Michael Chabon opera, The Cavalier and Clay. Yes. They do 5 operas a year plus a musical. And they also do like huge operas. Like I remember a couple years ago they were doing Falstaff. It looks like they have an upcoming performance of Sweeney Todd this year, like later this month. It is it's just like a scale that no other music school in the entire country can possibly compete with. Including that being that, like, you're often competing with doctoral students and, like, people who are much older than you for these roles.
All right. So what do we think here, guys? Texas or Indiana?
This one's a little tighter for me. I think it comes down to the question of, you know, the double rolling of the dice versus, you know, maybe not quite having the same amount of connections or opportunities. Because even with five large operas, you know, how many, there are not that many huge opera stages in the U.S., right? How useful is that compared to something smaller scale like Rape of Lucretia that, you know, you will be doing a lot more of post graduation? I'm leaning towards Indiana just because of the connections element, but I'm not sure.
I mean, I have to say the faculty is more prestigious, for lack of a word. I know that my friends at UNT are like, how dare you, you know? But I mean, I want to sing with Carol Venice, and maybe she's a terrible teacher, but like, I don't care. I want to hear stories from her.
You know she's got them.
So where are you going to fall, Matt?
I got to vote for Indiana.
All right.
For our championship, we are pitting Curtis
Big Institute versus small
against Indiana University. So does the smallness of Curtis actually work as a disadvantage in this case, and that you're not getting real competition for opportunity? Like, isn't that part
Well, you
of
did
it?
Because you already competed with basically everyone who's trying to have a career during the audition process.
This is the problem, right? Because when it's this selective, if you have gotten into Curtis, you are almost guaranteed some kind of footprint in the opera industry, provided you stick with it, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas with Indiana, you are not. You have to fight for it a little bit.
And it's so easy to get lost in the masses. Whereas at Curtis, the opportunity, like, there are so few students there at a time that all of the performance opportunities are specifically geared towards what you are going to be good at. You as a student, as a performer, are going to be good at. I'm sure that it's not quite as utopic as they like to portray it. Like, that everyone shares everything and everyone gets equal performance opportunities. Like, there's no way that that's true. This is a competitive art form at a certain point. But competing with 25 singers versus competing with probably 10 times that, at least, at Jacobs.
I feel like Indiana, just because of the scale and the competition element, might be a more realistic sort of taste of what the industry is like. You know, too many singers competing for too few roles, and having to slide into roles and types of singing that you might not be altogether comfortable with, you know, it forces you, I think, and gives you more opportunities, I would imagine, to try new things outside of what you might have come into school with. Whereas I feel like if you go into Curtis with a certain vocal type and style of singing, as long as your professors agree with you, you are going to stick with that. You're not going to try, you know, a turn in another type of singing or style, would be my guess.
The other thing about Indiana is if you go there and it turns out that, you know, they're not interested after all. You know, they admitted you, but they don't actually want to cast you in anything.
Yep.
Where else are you going to go? Like, you're in a cornfield. Whereas when you're like smack dab in the middle of the Eastern Seaboard, like, you can make your own opportunities while you're still a student at Curtis. Like, I would imagine a whole lot easier than you can at Indiana.
I would say, like, if you're going to apply and you get accepted at both schools, it makes more sense for you as a person to go to Curtis, I think, pretty definitively. But if we're talking about the best program for an aspiring singer who wants to, like, you know, throw themselves into the industry and accept the shortcomings of the industry, maybe Indiana?
Okay, sounds like we're needing a tiebreaker here, OC.
Yeah.
Do we think Curtis is old-fashioned? Do we think Curtis doesn't have a perspective on other things that are happening in music, like what the trends are in music, because they are so small and, you know, it's really based on who's teaching there at the moment. Whereas like some place like Indiana might have, just because of the larger faculty, you might be able to find somebody who's like, oh, this person's really my thing, like my niche, you know? Am I making sense with what I'm proposing?
I think that finding niches is good. I think the future of opera as an art form is going to be finding these small niches and collaboration with less and less mainstream types of opera. And I think that you have more opportunities to explore more types of opera in a larger program versus a smaller one. And when you're talking about something with the reputation of Curtis, I think you're right. You might be more set up for conventional operatic success, but will that matter in 40 years if a lot of the large houses fall? You
know? I still think that the individual attention that you can get, even if it isn't maybe as broad-based as it might be at a school the scale of, because that's looking at the scale as only a positive thing. And we all know that going to a big school is not only a positive thing. Like, there's lots of drawbacks about that, and the primary one is going to be attention. And based on the fact that these are like young singers who are honing their craft, and even if not everything that they need for a whole career is going to be at their fingertips, the fact that they're getting that amount of one-on-one time is incomparable.
Okay, and you are in Philadelphia, and the food, I imagine, is better.
The cheesesteaks put it over the edge. Let's give it give it to Curtis.
Free throw.
Hello, Opera Box Score. It's PJ. We are feeling very fortunate here at the Metropolitan Opera. I'm here with Donald. It is not an evening. It is a daytime. It is the last of the dress rehearsals for La Rondine by Giacomo Puccini. And we're just having a great time. It's a Friday morning. The show really begins next week. And Donald has been sharing all kinds of insights with me, and I want to share some with you. I have never seen this opera before. It's between right now the second and the third and final act. Donald, tell us about what we're seeing, man.
Well, La Rondine was an odd man out in Puccini's canon. It was written for Vienna originally, but it never premiered there. It was Puccini's attempt at an operetta type. Sort of. Puccini cum Lehar. So the premiere was in Monte Carlo with a great Italian soprano, Gilla Dalla Rizza. It finally got to the Met in 1926 with Lucrezia Bori and Beniamino Gigli. And then there were sporadic performances up until Bori retired in 36. She did, I think she did most of the Magdas. Didn't come back to the Met until 2009 with Angela Gheorghiu, who was absolutely gorgeous in this. She had everything. And the first season they revived it, she was with her husband of the time, Roberto Alagna. A few seasons later, it came back with Giuseppe Filianotti, who was Italian tenor, who was one of my favorites. Mm. And there's been nothing since then, 2013. So this is the first performance in 11 years.
Amazing.
And it's a beautiful work. It's not Puccini's strongest work, but it's got some gorgeous music. The first two acts are wonderful. The third act peters out a little. It doesn't quite, he doesn't quite resolve it well.
What was the name of the first aria that Magda sings?
Il bel sogno di Doretta, the dream of Doretta.
I bring that up because my mother has sung that for my entire life. Piano, Christmas, my dad at the piano, my mother at that aria. So I know it. I've never seen this opera, but I knew the aria.
Although the sopranos do it, but it actually is a bit of a duet. It's one of Puccini's prettiest arias.
Tell us a little bit about the cast that we have here.
It's a good cast. We have Angel Blue, soprano. She's Magda. Emily Pogorelick. She's the Lisette. Very important debut because he's been touted very much. Jonathan Tettelman. This is his debut at the Met.
Wow.
It'll be Tuesday night.
Sounds so good.
And it's a beautiful voice, which we all knew from his recordings.
You're dropping the lead. Our heroine, rather, Amanda.
Amanda Battista, who was one of our prize winners, the Giulio Gari Foundation, last year, 2023. She's in the Matt Lindemann program, and she's got a pretty meaty role.
Not kidding. She's doing a lot of singing in this thing. Yeah. She's right at the top.
She's Bianca. Magda would be a perfect role for her, and I have a funny feeling she might be the cover for this. We got to ask her.
All right, one more piece of business, Donald, sure. And that is the Giulio Gari Foundation. We are both involved, and that's how we met, in fact. The deadline for the competition this spring is coming up. Tell us what's going on.
Okay, we have our competition May 6th, 7th, and 8th, with the finals on May 10th.
So you are the gatekeeper. You're already listening. Yes. We have another 3 weeks, it seems, 2 to 3 weeks.
April 15th is the cutoff.
It's in New York. May 6th through 10, it's a great event. It's a great way to be seen by a lot of important people and maybe qualify for a grant or win one of the prizes, a lot of money at stake. And then in the fall is the big gala and concert. That's the Giulio Gari Foundation. Just for the record, giuliogari.org, in addition to Yap Tracker, is where you can find it. This is PJ and
Donald
in between acts at the Metropolitan Opera. We will see you again.
Thank you to PJ and Donald for that report from the Metropolitan Opera. Just a reminder that La Rondinée will close April 20th, but you'll have an opportunity to see the final performance in HD. Send us a voice memo or email us your hot takes at mailbag@operaboxscore.com, or just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com.
This just in, the 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Operaland this week.
News from the home team. Klaus Mäkelä has been tapped as the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's new music director designate. The 28-year-old Finnish conductor will officially take the helm in 2027, making him the youngest music director in the history of the CSO.
In other home team news, Chicago's mayor, Brandon Johnson, has officially declared April 5th Chicago Opera Theater Day. Well, founded in 1973 by Alan Stone, COT has grown from a grassroots, community-based company to a national leader in an increasingly vibrant, diverse, and forward-thinking art form, reads the declaration. The 50th anniversary gala provides a momentous opportunity to reflect on remarkable achievements of the past and celebrate the vibrant present.
Miami Lyric Opera is shutting down after 22 years of operation. Quote, venue, labor, musician, and artist costs and others have all increased, said MLO founder and general director Rafaela Cordon, who added that the closure would mark his retirement as well. I am almost 90 and in excellent health. I will continue to provide my experience to new talents while enjoying my grandchildren and listening to good music.
English composer George Benjamin has been awarded the Frontiers of Knowledge Award in the music and opera category. The opera house is where I have had my most precious experiences, said the composer. I find myself losing the concept of time and place and feel entirely united with what's happening in the music.
According to the New York Times, the announcement of Opera Philadelphia's upcoming run of Madame Butterfly seems to apologize for the production's very existence, offering fretful assurances that the staging, quote, illuminates and ultimately transcends harmful stereotypes. That's from Zachary Wolf's column, Puccini's Butterfly and Turandot, More Than Appropriation, which offers some history behind these operas set in Asia and the 21st century approach to performing them. The article will be linked on our website, and Friend of the Show Opera Philadelphia's Butterfly production with Friend of the Show Anthony Clark Evans as Sharpless opens on April 26th.
In trade news, International Friends of Festival Verdi has announced the appointment of Michael J. Bolton, formerly of Opera Philadelphia, to the position of executive director. Meanwhile, the Metropolitan Opera has tapped German conductor Tilman Michael to be the company's new chorus master. And Medici TV founder and managing director Hervé Bossière has stepped down from the streaming service after almost 20 years.
And on this day, April 8th, first performances include Handel's Oratorio, The Resurrection in 1708, Niccolò Piccinni's Didone Abbandonata in 1770 in Rome, Antonio Salieri's Azur Re Dormus in 1788 in Vienna, Gioacchino Rossini's L'Inganno Felice in 1812 in Venice, Saverio Mercadante's Statira in 1853 in Naples, and Amilcare Ponchielli's La Gioconda at La Scala in 1876. Birthdays on April 8th include conductor Sir Adrian Bolt, born in Chester, England in 1889.
Born a sir.
Tenor Raoul Jobin, a Canadian tenor born in Quebec in 1906. Italian tenor Franco Corelli, born in Ancona in 1921. Bass baritone Walter Berry, born in Vienna in 1929. And American baritone John Reardon, born this day in New York City in 1930. Happy birthday to English mezzo-soprano and friend of a mother of a friend of the show, Diana Montague. She was born in 1953.
Mother-in-law of the show.
1957, happy birthday to you, English baritone Anthony Michaels Moore. And on this day, April 8th, it was the birthday of English soprano Janice Watson. Happy birthday, Miss Watson, born this day in 1964 in London.
And that is your 2 minute drill.
We got a twofer for you tonight. That was OBS Hall of Famer Franco Corelli singing Enzo's aria Cielo e Mar from the birthday boy La Gioconda. The birthday girl, I guess, La Gioconda. That performance looks like it's from Italian TV. There's some excellent crossfading and very out of sync mouth and words.
Love that. I mean, just as Ponchielli intended, really. Let's talk a little bit about something a little uncharacteristic for us. Let's leave the world of opera behind us for just a moment, because we had the big news last week that Klaus Mäkelä was going to be the new music director, taking over from Riccardo Muti, going from just a real age drop between those two music directors. And my question to you both is, what does Mäkelä's appointment mean, if anything, for the Chicago opera scene?
It's reinvigorating people's interest in the orchestra. I went to the first of three performances that were originally scheduled to have Yuja Wang playing the Bartok Piano Concerto, but ended up being Sol Gabetta playing Shostakovich's first cello concerto with Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. And I mean, the house was full on a Thursday night, which was great. But people were so excited. Yeah. And I think people didn't even know what was going on per se, but they just felt that something was going on. And when Klaus Mäkelä came out at the beginning of the show, people started applauding and wanted him to like take a bow, like a real bow, not just like, thank you for welcoming me to the stage bow, you know?
Yeah.
And absolutely. he shut it down. He's like, no. Let's get on with this concert.
I'm here to work.
Yes, exactly.
I'm here for the art.
And one of the things that musicians have been saying about Klaus Mäkelä is that he really wants the players to feel free. He wants them to like, you know, show off their technical ability, and he wants them to feel like he's not, you know, making so many decisions, you know, that it's really their. This is your moment of the symphony. Good. Drive it, you know? And you could see it in the way he conducts, that he stops even, you know, really beating, like when there's a clear soloistic moment or a sectional, you know, moment, he just like lets them run with it. And that's a recipe for things falling apart. But somehow
and
on the
very
night.
Very different from Muti's style.
Yes. Very much so.
And the musicians really enjoy playing for him. They're like excited to play for him. And that that translates, I think, into higher morale, you know?
Yeah.
So, and plus he's he's handsome. He's got an overbite, but, you know, he's still handsome.
He's European. Their teeth are different.
I mean, I wish it would have been a woman. I wish it would have been a person of color. But if we're going to go with a cisgender heterosexual male, might as well make it one that has a very hard name to spell.
Well, I was thinking that it was surprisingly young. I was dreading another, because there were rumors a while back that like Christian Tielemann was like going to.
I remember those, yeah. Which is like, wow, let's go from old school to even older school there.
I think that it's exciting. I'm glad they're going with someone who's really young, younger than me, if you can believe it. Because, you know, I think that having that youthful energy is very exciting. Obviously, the odds of having Yujo Wang come perform with CSO has gone down considerably since he's taken over, but that's okay. I think the biggest potential loss, at least in terms of opera, is the fact that Riccardo Muti is an Italian opera guy. Klaus Mäkelä, to my knowledge, I did a lot of Googling. I don't know if he's conducted any operas, at least on any of his bigger appointments.
I mean, he's too young to have even seen an opera. So
from some Googling, it looks like he's done a magic flute before.
Okay. Well, okay, then we're fine. I think that obviously Chicago Symphony Orchestra is not the place to go in Chicago for consistent operas. They do occasionally do them. It's very strange because he's so young. He already has an exclusive contract with Decca, but I believe he only has like 3 albums out, no vocal music of any kind so far, which isn't to say that he can't do them because he's so young. He might become a vocal music person, but this will be, I think, very different for the CSO audience. I am hopeful, given his choice of repertoire and his youth, that he might be able to bring some more unusual operatic repertoire that is too hard to stage to the CSO stage. But, you know, that remains to be seen if that's even something he's interested in. But we'll find out in a few years when he officially takes over.
An interesting trend that I do want to call out that is continuing here from like when we were talking about Yannick Nézet-Séguin, is he is currently the music director of Oslo Philharmonic and Orchestra de Paris.
Yes.
Both of those appointments are going to end in the 26-27 season, and he has stated that he intends to stand down and not have his contract renewed in either one of them. However, at the same year that he starts his position at CSO, he is also starting a position as the chief conductor for the Concertgebouw in
Amsterdam.
In Amsterdam. So
big position.
We're still in the age of the jet set conductor. Like, this is not, it remains to be seen exactly how much, like, how close of a relationship he's going to have with the city of Chicago itself versus whether or not, whether or not he's actually just going to, like, physically have the time to be here very much. I really hope he does. I hope that he does create like a rapport with not just the musicians, but like also the audience. Like, I think that's fair to ask for as a member of the CSO audience, like from the music director. But this is kind of how things have been going in the arts organization world, like for a while now, is that like fewer and fewer names have more and more of the jobs. And I don't know that it's been like a ringing success. And I am curious to see like what ends up transpiring here.
So his statement that he gave when they made this big press, which was very well timed, I have to say, like the PR blitz that came out, like when this announcement was made, I was really impressed with Chicago's.
It leaked from Slip Desk a couple days in advance, but like I did not hear it otherwise.
But I'm saying that like it was very well coordinated. We had like NPR talking about it. We had the New Yorker talking about it. Obviously, all the local news organizations were talking about it. So they really, they had this embargo out and everybody like released their thing when they were supposed to. And it made a very big impact. He said, "I'm honored to have been chosen as music director of the CSO and inspired to embark on this journey with an orchestra that combines such brilliance, power, and passion." So that is his, you know, 3 words to describe CSO: brilliant, powerful, and passionate. And I wonder if that is a suggestion about how he distinguishes, you know, CSO from the other jobs that he has, Paris, Oslo, mm-hmm. and Concertgebouw, you know? And if he's going to try to, you know, show off more of the powerful, you know, muscular repertoire, orchestral repertoire, like more Shostakovich, more Mahler, you know, this Titanic type of stuff that really showcases the brass.
In George Schulte's orchestra?
Yeah. And
brass, how, you say?
How vocal music will fall into that. Maybe we'll get a concert version of Elektra, you know?
Mm-hmm. Who knows? That'd be cool. Maybe they'll do all seven operas of the Licht cycle. I can dream.
For sure.
You sure will be dreaming.
Let's move away from symphony box score and talk a little bit more about opera.
Wait. Just one last comment. I should have made it when we were talking about it. But maybe his interest in vocal music will depend on who he dates next.
Oh.
Piano concertos out. Orchestrated song cycles, however.
Do we have any like really avant-garde sopranos who are big Stockhausen fans who are single right now?
That's a project for you, I think, independently, to work out.
I'll start working on it right away. Let's talk a little bit about Orientalism in opera. There's this article that we have linked on our website, operaboxscore.com, talking about specifically Madame Butterfly and Turandot, the big two in terms of Asian appropriation. And this Zachary Wolf article, which I think is actually fairly well written and makes some cogent points, about how, you know, at what point do you forgive, at what point do you think about the context of the time period? At what point do you make changes? Is there a point to apologizing if people are still going and seeing these works and not objecting? I think these are all questions we've talked about before on the show to some extent. I think that my position is and always has been that we should be striving to have an educated enough audience to be able to assimilate these works and receive critiques of these works as part of the performance, as part of sort of the meta performance of programs and presentations and stuff like that. But until we have that educated audience in place, I think this is kind of an interesting article to sort of begin that discussion about what do we do with these kinds of appropriative Orientalist works.
And I do find it interesting, like, to be sure, this article is a far cry from the one in the New York Post that we talked about a couple weeks ago. That was like, the headline was like, woke libs apologize for the existence of Turandot. But it is interesting that, like, the conversation around these pieces has at some point, like, kind of taken on a life of its own and become its own, like, meta conversation about, like, at what, like, there does seem to be this undercurrent of, like, so, like, when can we stop talking about it? And I'm not sure that that answer is anything other than never, like, in today's society. Like,
totally agree.
The thing is that we are Americans and we are, you know, considered in the world, at least compared to Europe, as being woke about these things. And, you know, Arena de Verona is going to keep on being Arena de Verona. But we're thinking about these things. And I like that it's a concern and more people are realizing, oh, we should be embarrassed about, you know, some of these traditions. And stop the things that are like, you know, yellow face or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
That is a step. I don't want to lose these pieces. And I do want us to try to use these pieces as a way to understand as much as we can about these cultures. The things that were understood about them in the turn of the century are different than what we understand about them now. But yeah. I don't think that Puccini was necessarily trying to be racist, trying to belittle these things.
If
it was
anything,
a fascination.
It seems,
you know?
Yeah, if anything, it seems like it was a wanting to pay like some sort of respect to the culture, but it was admittedly a culture that he did not really understand very well. Yeah. So like that is not an unambiguously like good or bad thing. And you can't put that framing on this kind of discussion because like it just doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But like both things, I think, have to be stated in order for people to understand, like, where did this come from? And, like, why are we still doing it today? Because I agree, like, that, like, there's kind of a pat refrain sometimes of, like, well, just don't do them. And, like, I don't really think that's the answer either.
No.
Like, there are these are, like, very powerful works of musical drama that, like, deserve to be seen and heard, but, like, not just, like, Xerox copied from one, like, people in kimonos from one production to another. Like, that is not the way to go about doing Butterfly in today's, like, day and age.
Yeah, and there are so many operas throughout history that do get erased, that fall out of the repertoire unjustly, that have a lot to say that, you know, if they could only have remained in the repertoire for a couple more decades, would have been just as beloved as anything that we're seeing now. And I think that it would be a mistake to just say, this is too hard for us to contend with here in the 21st century. Let's delete it. And I do think we have the advantage now of recordings. So, like, you know, we don't have the, you know, specter of this will be lost forever in the same way that an opera written 120 years ago would have been lost forever. But there is, like I said, you know, it's all about priming, creating a better audience. It's about making people engage, which makes them better at digesting not just opera, but art in general, better at digesting politics,
media literacy,
right?
Yeah, there's one line in this article that really, I think, speaks to that, which is, but in Chocho-san, there is more than just a reinforcement of the trope of the demure, passively abused geisha. She has, as the musicologist Arthur Gross wrote in 2016, quote, a complexity of character unmatched in the fin de siècle Italian opera. Like, that is part that doesn't get brought up in the same way. Like, yes, there have been how many conversations, and, like, this is a panel full of men, and we're talking about, like, how opera is mean to women. That's true. But, like, just because the situation of the opera is stacked against her, that is not necessarily an endorsement. Like, I don't come away from Butterfly thinking, like, oh, that Pinkerton, what a nice guy. It's too bad that they didn't work out. Like, sometimes portraying something can be an indictment of it.
Everybody who sees this opera realizes that Pinkerton is a jerk, and I want to use a different word, but we're a family show, and that Lady Pinkerton, whatever, Kate Pinkerton, is it also in a very bad position because of her jerk of a husband. You know? So it's like white toxic masculinity is what you come away with in this show.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, you know, there is a lot of questions about Orientalism, the combining of Chinese and Japanese themes without really making a line between those things. But when you realize that any piece of art, even something made today, is going to have the same problems in 100 years, according to, you know, as people develop through society and realize, ooh, that doesn't age very well, you know, I think it behooves all of us to be able to critique and understand the opera, operas and other works of art without necessarily tossing them out. We could talk about this, obviously, forever, but
and we will
have one more quick, important question to ask both of you. Can we petition Brandon Johnson for a Chicago Opera podcast day?
I mean, we could, but the thing is that, you know, Brandon Johnson, I don't know him. And it's just funny that, like, there are these proclamations. How much does Brandon Johnson actually know about Chicago Opera Theater and its history? And
number
about,
one fan.
About,
you don't know. Maybe he was at the Nose.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, I mean, it's great that this happened. But, you know, he's a new mayor. I don't know what his taste in music is or what he cares about, you know. But, you know, to make this statement about Alan Stone and about how it's grassroots and community-based, like, that, though, those words just feel jargony to me. It's true. I mean, everything he says, it's actually true about the company. But, you know, there were some periods of Chicago Opera Theater where it wasn't so great. And I'm not talking about the Lydia Yankovskaya era, but there was an era before that where it was like, ugh.
Half-baked Central over here.
No, thanks.
Well, we'll have to get Brandon Johnson on the show and ask him what his opinions are about Stockhausen so I can have him order Klaus Mäkelä to do a full cycle for us.
Like a dog with a bone today, dub-dubs.
Let's wrap up this show.
Good call, bad call on Opera Box Score.
Good call, bad call. It's how we end the show. Oliver Camacho.
If you're listening to this episode on the day that it drops and you live in the, Baltimore area, check out A Pregnant Pause, a new opera by Garth Baxter and Elise Francesca Rosnai. It's an opera which centers women, their rights, their reproductive decisions, and the practicality and feasibility of bearing children in our current world. It's called A Pregnant Pause. It has a world premiere on April 12th at the Carroll County Arts Center in Westminster, Maryland.
Matt Cummings.
There is a video that came across my social media feed today that we are going to be linking out to from our website, which features the classic pairing of soprano Nadine Sierra and Chicago gay stand-up comedian Matteo Lane, who is someone who, like, my algorithm is like, you definitely want to watch his videos. And, like, they're kind of right. Like, they're quite funny. But he is, like, a Chicago native who went to art school here and is, like, a painter and had studied opera. So he's very, you know, knowledgeable about the arts and, like, very excited to share that knowledge with Nadine Sierra and to get more from her. That the feature includes a couple duets, one of which is from Don Giovanni and one of which is a Disney duet. So check that out.
At least one of those people has not been on the show. That is it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about Opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get your voice heard and find links to stuff we've talked about at our website, operaboxscore.com. And that's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. Give back to the OBS using the Support the Team tab. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant is Oliver Camacho. And your audio editor is me. For our co-host Matt Cummings, I'm Weston Williams, asking you to continue the conversation about opera as you make Curtis your top choice and have no backup plan. We're back with an all-new show next week when Harry Bickett takes a free throw on being pigeonholed as an early music specialist. Plus, you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more Finnish overbites. Join us. Definitely sounds like a sex position.
Leave it in.
Leave it in.